Okay, we're going to call the long-term care division meeting to order. I have a couple of reminders about the future of the meetings. We don't have a quorum yet, so we'll wait on the minutes. Our next meeting, Monday, February 11th, we're going to have HHS policy meet at our designated time, so we will not be meeting. And then the following week, February 18th, we're going to learn about tribal governance, so all committees, no committees will be meeting on Monday, February 18th. And then going forward, we'll start hearing individual bills, so hopefully elder abuse bills, EWRS, all the good stuff. So I want to take a moment. I think Assistant Commissioner Daniel Pollack wants to introduce himself and his new role. Why don't you go forward?
Madam Chair, thank you. Dan Pollack with DHS. I just wanted to say hi and kick this portion off of the presentation, which will focus on some of the DHS programs and systems that I'll be overseeing now. I'm now the Assistant Commissioner for the Continuing Care and Older Adults Administration at DHS, which is, for those of you who've been around for a while, they used to kind of be combined under Claire Wilson, and she had disability and aging. And so now we're splitting into two. There will be an assistant commissioner hired soon who will focus on disability services and housing, and we'll be able to have that person introduce themselves as well. And I'm looking forward to working with this committee and with each of you in your individual capacities as well. Obviously, I think you're all very familiar that there's been a lot of really good collaboration between DHS and MDH over the last year, and I'm hoping to continue a lot of that progress and work that I'll now be sitting in part of as DHS Assistant Commissioner. And my staff will also be reaching out to you to set up individual one-on-ones and just want to chat and hear about ideas or legislation that are of priority to you as well. So thank you so much for the time, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Assistant Commissioner Pollack. I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot of you here in this committee and in our other committees. So really glad that you're going to be helping lead long-term care and supportive services. Okay, I believe we have a quorum now, so do I hear a motion to approve the minutes from January 28th?
So.
Okay, Representative Jeremy Munson moves the minutes from January 28th. Any discussion, corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? No one's opposed. Okay, minutes pass. Okay, today we are going to be hearing about the results from the work group meetings that have been meeting all fall to address different issues on all our vulnerable adult protection services, assisting living report cards, consumer rights in long-term care, and the dementia standards work group being presented by the Alzheimer's Association. So first on deck, we have Carrie Benson, the Director of Aging and Adult Services for DHS. Welcome, Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Carrie Benson. I'm the Director of the Aging and Adult Services Division at the Department of Human Services. And in that role, I also serve as Executive Director for the Minnesota Board on Aging. Last week, you had heard from Jan Malcolm, the Commissioner at the Health Department, regarding the role of the Health Department, Office of Health Facility Complaints, in our adult protection system. And so what we wanted to start with today is to step back a little bit and talk about the overall adult protection system. And then I'll be talking about how maltreatment reporting occurs, the role of the MARC, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, what happens after a report is made to the MARC, and then I'll end with data highlights on trends in maltreatment reporting. When we talk about the adult protection system, it's important to be clear about who we are talking about. At the center of our system is a vulnerable adult, and that is anyone age 18 or older who has a physical, mental, or emotional disorder that makes it difficult for them to care for themselves and protect themselves from maltreatment. This person might be in a hospital, nursing home, assisted living, foster care, or other licensed facility, and they might receive services such as home care services or day services, personal care assistance, or other licensed services. So that person, as you can see by the picture in front of you, is in the center of our system, and the overall system is in place to protect that individual against maltreatment, and that can include abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. So just a little bit more about the functions of the system. You see that on the left-hand side of your slide in front of you. The first function is reporting, and that involves reporting suspected maltreatment, abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation by mandated reporters or by members of the public. The second major function is the response to that report. The civil response is undertaken by the lead investigative agencies. You'll see here there's County Adult Protection Services, DHS licensing, and then the Health Department, Office of Health Facility Complaints. And there are adult protective services involved in offering the vulnerable adult support and services that they might need, even ongoing after the initial response. And then the protection involves that ongoing support and maybe social services, data sharing, a lot of coordination happening between components of this system, including law enforcement, medical examiner, and the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. Each entity identified on this slide, this goes into a little bit more detail, more broadly encompassing of really the entire adult protection system, and each entity on this slide has an important role to play in adult protection. And, you know, whether it be that providing consultation, prevention, education, or services to the vulnerable adult. And the coordination amongst these entities is very critical. The functions of the adult protection system are outlined in the Vulnerable Adult Act. The VAA establishes the state's response to suspected maltreatment of a vulnerable adult and supports the dignity for vulnerable adults by supporting victims and holding perpetrators accountable through civil investigation. The civil maltreatment reporting and response system coordinates with law enforcement, but is not a criminal response system or an adjunct 911 system. And there are other systems, then, that are responsible for the actual prevention of maltreatment. So those are all components of this, of the overall system, as outlined in the Vulnerable Adult Act. The next slide shows you a very busy picture, which you also have a copy of in front of you, larger, hopefully easier to read copy. More detailed for your reference, main components of our reporting and investigation process related to potential maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. And these are the components that, you know, I've mentioned probably many of them already in my presentation, and I'll be talking about them in some more detail in the following slides. Historically, maltreatment reporting occurred by individuals calling what might have been one of over 160 phone numbers that were in place. So each county had designated contacts for people to call if they suspected that maltreatment was occurring. And depending on what time of day or what the situation was and where the person was located, it was very hard for people to understand where to report suspected maltreatment. So the department worked with many other partners in coming to consensus around the need for a centralized reporting system for the state and the development of a statewide common entry point. And we worked with partners through the efforts convened and led by the Minnesota Elder Justice Center in 2009. And that was really the beginning of the work to then really establish, make it a reality that we had a statewide common entry point. Legislation was passed in 2013 to, along with funding, to establish the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. And this is now the civil reporting system for suspected vulnerable adult maltreatment in Minnesota. You'll see by the information on this slide, the MARC, as we refer to it as, is available at any time to take in reports of suspected maltreatment. It was launched July 1, 2015, and it's operated by the Department of Human Services. We have a contract with a call center vendor to operate the MARC. It's a Minnesota-based call center. It has it's based in Bloomington, but it has three locations in greater Minnesota also.
Stop you there, Ms. Benson. I believe you have a question, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide number two of that, the bubble diagram, I just had a question. I don't know if somebody sat on the keyboard or if that's an actual the OMBAMHDD. What is that? Is it the ombudsman or if I can ask for clarification?
Madam Chair. It is Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities.
Okay. And as a follow-up, Madam Chair, how does that – is that a part of the LIA or is that completely separate?
It is a separate entity and has a separate role in the process, and I'll get to that in just a few slides here, I think, okay. As far as the response.
Just one more. And then as far as the law enforcement bubble – is there cooperation between either the ILA or the OMBHDDD or MHDD with law enforcement, or is that kind of a separate, do they do that work alongside each other during the investigation?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, they do cooperate, and I will talk about that at least at a high level in my presentation here, too, as far as how the process unfolds once a report is made and all the different partners that are involved in that, but there's definitely cooperation and both in terms of a civil investigation and if there's a potential crime involved, then there's a criminal response too.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the longest acronym I've seen so far in HHS, so thanks for pointing that out, Representative Munson. Representative Grunhagen, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a quick question on the referrals to law enforcement. Do we know what percent actually result in a conviction?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, I do not have that information as far as the conviction. About half of all referrals that the MARC makes are also then to law enforcement as well as a civil lead investigative agency. But that's where our information about the end result stops there.
So, Grunhagen?
Well, thank you, Madam. So, in other words, when you makes a referral to law enforcement, the department never finds out what the result is?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, the information is input back into the system for the MARC, but it is a limited data set, and at this point we are still pulling that all together as far as the for each of the full reports since the launch of the MARC.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other question? No. Please proceed, Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next section of my presentation will go into maltreatment reporting. The website address at the top of the slide in front of you is the web reporting system that was designed for mandated reporters to use to make a report into the MARC. Mandated reporters, as listed here, are identified in Minnesota statute, and we provide a mandated reporter guide, and that's linked to the web form. Public reporting or voluntary reporters are encouraged to call the MARC phone number to make a report of suspected maltreatment. Reporters are guided through the process to make their report and share the information that they have by the call center staff at the MARC. Mandated reporters may also use the phone reporting system. And like I said, under statute, reporting is based on suspected maltreatment on the part of the reporter who is calling in. So each report is as accurate as information provided by the reporter. And all reports are accepted by the MARC.
So, Ms. Benson, how do they know the number to dial? How are people informed about the MARC and how it's where it's available? Is that something that has to be posted everywhere?
Madam Chair, we do work with many, many partners in terms of posting the number for individuals to be aware of, but it's a work in progress. You have, I think, in front of you some materials from our public awareness campaign that we implemented at the launch of the MARC. And we are just now undertaking a process to review and launch again a second phase effort to raise awareness of the MARC. But it's a constant effort, educational awareness raising effort on our part and the part of many, many partners.
Thank you.
Whether through the phone or the web form, the information that we collect regarding a report of suspected maltreatment is the same. And you'll see here there's the general categories of information that's collected. And it's collected by the reporter who is either, you know, submitting the web form or making the phone call. So it is based on their knowledge and perspective and the information they have available to them. The next item that we like to stress is what the MARC does not do with reports that it receives. As I mentioned earlier, MARC does take in all reports of suspected maltreatment. It does not refuse to accept reports. It does not screen out reports. And we really leave, the MARC really leaves the decisions on how to respond to reports, either on the civil side or, of course, the criminal side, to the entities responsible, so either the civil lead investigative agencies or law enforcement agencies. So I want to go into a little bit more detail in terms of what MARC does with those reports that it receives. This gets into some of those components on the diagram that you also have in front of you. When the MARC receives a report in through the web or the phone, it determines the lead investigative agency responsible for that report and forwards it to that LIA, determines the law enforcement jurisdiction and forwards the report to them if a crime is alleged, determines if the license holder is state or federally regulated, refers to the medical examiner and or the ombudsman for mental health and developmental disabilities, and that's in the case of a suspicious death. And it also makes a referral to counties for emergency protective services if that is called for based on the information provided by the reporter. The lead investigative agencies include the Department of Health, Office of Health Facility Complaints, and they are the LIA, or the lead investigative agency, if the person lives at a facility licensed by the health department, such as nursing home, or receives home care and assisted living, for example. The Department of Human Services Licensing Division is the lead investigative agency if the person lives in a setting that DHS licenses, such as chemical dependency center, treatment center, or foster care, or receives home and community-based services licensed by DHS. And then finally, the county is the lead investigative agency if the person has immediate protection needs, so that gets into the emergency protective services, or if there are no licensed services involved. So really, in one way of thinking about it, they are the lead investigative agency for everybody else other than individuals who are receiving services overseen by the health department or DHS. The time frames that are listed on this next slide, slide 16 in front of you, are the time frames that the MARC call center is currently needing for all reports on average. And these are based on the time it takes for them to make a referral after report completion. So a referral either to LIA, stands for Lead Investigative Agency, or referral to law enforcement, medical examiner, or ombudsman for mental health or developmental disabilities. These, the call referral times that they are meeting currently are well within the statutory guidelines, which are 2 working days for referral to a lead investigative agency, or 24 hours for referral to either emergency protective services, law enforcement, medical examiner, or the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. In terms of the coordination with law enforcement, first off, referral to law enforcement is based on the type of maltreatment alleged by the reporters. So the MARC call center staff are trained to make immediate notification to law enforcement. And so that's where the involvement of law enforcement and then the coordination with them as a partner in the system begins.
Ms. Benson, on the previous slide, why is there such a big difference between a web report and a phone report in terms of time? 30 minutes versus 4 hours.
The The phone reports are prioritized, Madam Chair, the phone reports are prioritized in terms of processing by the call center staff so that they are able to answer each phone call as it's coming in and really cut down on that wait time. And then the web reports are submitted throughout a 24-hour period, and so they are then processed as the call center staff are able to. And like I said, still with very, very much within the statutory guidelines, but it's on average within the 4 hours.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. I believe Representative Munson also has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on slide number 9 about the mandated reporting requirements. Just from reading this, it appears that they have a duty to report, but is this based on an opinion, like for a provider or a PCA? Do they have a laundry list of items that they must report on, or is it just kind of based on their opinion on what they hear?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, it is based on criteria that are dependent on each of the different licensed facilities and services that there are situations in which they have to report. But then it also, what factors in also is their professional judgment into that also.
Yes, I think Representative Lippert has a question as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the web reports, is the person processing that report able to ask clarifying questions in the same way that someone with a phone call would, or is it just kind of a blank or a standard response that's issued?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, the MARC call center staff are not able to ask and do not ask the follow-up questions regarding the web form submitted, but they are able to then they refer those on for further checking into and following up with the individuals by the lead investigative agency.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Benson.
Any other questions? Okay, please proceed, Ms. Benson.
Okay, so the next section of my presentation is about what happens after the MARC report is made, and what the at least at a general level, I don't want to get into a lot of detail at this point, but at least at a general level, what the lead investigative agency does once they receive a report from the MARC. The investigative guidelines that are outlined on this slide are applicable to all of the lead investigative agencies. So this is a guidelines that are laid out in statute and so are followed by the County Adult Protection Services, DHS, and the Health Department. Each lead investigative agency, though, establishes their own guidelines to prioritize reports for civil investigation. One of the functions of the adult protection team in my division is to support the county adult protection services. And so as an example, I just wanted to offer up that the counties, we require them to use a standardized decision-making tool to determine investigation and then the process that they will follow in terms of which reports to open and which require adult protective services. However, they do have their own local prioritization guidelines to that factor in. On the following slide lists again the entities that are required in statute to cooperate and share data for investigation and protection of vulnerable adults. And this is, of course, within their resources, their expertise, and their legal authorization. The determination by a lead investigative agency on whether or not maltreatment, as defined by statute, has occurred is based on a preponderance of evidence. Preponderance is defined in statute as more than 50%. Substantiated means a preponderance of the evidence shows that an act that meets the definition of maltreatment has occurred. False means a preponderance of the evidence shows that an act that meets the definition of maltreatment did not occur. Inconclusive means there is less than a preponderance of evidence to show that maltreatment did or did not occur. And finally, no determination will be made is defined as and only found during investigation when there is not a vulnerable adult or the lead investigative agency is not able to complete investigation as a vulnerable adult is unable to be located.
Well, Ms. Benson, those that are inconclusive or no determination made, do you hold on to those, file those, retain those records?
Yes, we do retain those records. There are guidelines around how long the different types of reports are retained. And somewhere in my pile of paper, I have the answer to that.
Okay. You can follow up with me later on the length that you retain those records. Mm-hmm. If you get a similar complaints with the same facility, do you go back and see if you have, in those retained files, if there's any other reports from that same facility?
Madam Chair, each lead investigative agency does that type of analysis and work, and what we are working towards now, because of the MARC being that central repository, we're working to connect those data points right now across lead investigative agencies and other factors or components in any given report. And so that, at this point, is a work in progress across all of them. But, yes, within each LIA, they can. And I did find the information about the how long the reports are kept. Mm-hmm. For false conclusions, they are kept for 3 years. No disposition is 3 years. Inconclusive is 4, and substantiated is 7. The MARC retains records for 3 years.
Okay, thank you.
The timelines and required notifications outlined here are regarding when Emergency Adult Protective Services is notified, but also then the notification of different parties involved in a situation, either the initial disposition or the final disposition regarding a report of potential maltreatment. Of course, Emergency Adult Protective Services is immediate. That occurs when MARC screens the reports of alleged or suspected maltreatment for immediate risk and then, you know, makes necessary referrals, and that is one of those that is immediate. Notification is required to the vulnerable adult or identified others when investigation is not completed within the 60 days, as you'll see that investigation final disposition, 60 days is that time frame. Final disposition requirement notifications apply to the vulnerable adult or guardian or healthcare agent with appropriate powers. The vulnerable adult reconsideration and appeal rights apply to the vulnerable adult and others identified to act for the vulnerable adult within the state statute, the Vulnerable Adult Act. County Adult Protective Services may continue past the final investigation determination until the vulnerable adult is safe or conditionally safe. If the investigation is not completed within 60 days, all lead investigative agencies have the opportunity to extend the time frame that they have for that investigation for another 60 days. And there's no limitation on the extensions to complete the investigation. The time frames shown on this slide are the time frames within which either the vulnerable adult, interested party, or alleged perpetrator have to file an appeal. Alleged perpetrators may only appeal substantiated determinations. A vulnerable adult or interested party may appeal substantiated, false, or inconclusive determinations. The first level of appeal for either is to the lead investigative agency for reconsideration. If the party is dissatisfied with reconsideration, the second level of appeal differs then. For the vulnerable adult, that second level of appeal is the maltreatment review panel, and for the alleged perpetrator, it is the Department of Human Services appeals. If there's a criminal case pending within this situation, the civil appeal timeframes may be impacted by that. And the civil court is an appeal option for alleged perpetrators, and of course nothing precludes a vulnerable adult from using the court system as well. Each lead investigative agency has different tools to act upon. The evidence discovered during an investigation, and these are civilly based, of course, for the lead investigative agencies. They can include licensing fines, license suspension, or provider disqualification. The civil remedies that are available are based on the licensing statutes, both for DHS and MDH, for the Department of Human Services and the Health Department.
Ms. Spence, I'm going to stop you there. We have another question. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a problem with the preponderance of evidence. And the reason I have a problem with that is because too many times when I've talked with people who live in senior housing or have had parents in various facilities, it's the fact that item one, the people are treated with disrespect. And I'm wondering if what some of these, what I would call the victims, they, whatever they say may not be treated as fully factual. So how do you, is preponderance of evidence the right amount of to determine to proceed? Is that clear?
So I think Ms. Benson, she's asking, you said that more than 50% preponderance. So how did you determine that threshold of 50%? And maybe give us some examples of preponderance or bring someone down who can. Go ahead, Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I guess I would first say that that is laid out in statute as far as the guidelines around that, as well as you've probably noticed quite a few statutory references, you know, throughout the presentation, and there is a lot spelled out there. But then it also does connect to very much the need for training and, you know, support of professionals in the field and, you know, mandated reporters broadly. So I think that is a constant need for us to provide.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
My final section of my presentation on the adult protection system and the MARC, I'll walk through data on the volume and type of reports and referrals made to the MARC. You'll see that on this line graph, the line that starts much lower than the others, that's the launch of the MARC, July 1, 2015. We saw a spike in call volume, early in that half of the year in 2015, and then it's leveled off to a large degree as far as having some pretty consistent reporting ebbs and flows, I guess, with the volume. On the far left-hand side of the chart that you're looking at, the line graph, the very dark, heavy line is the beginning of 2019 that we're tracking with the call volume, and appears to be following about the same trend in January and beginning of February of last year and the years before, too. Moving on to the next slide, calendar year 18, the MARC received 57,246 reports of suspected maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. This includes reports from the public and from mandated reporters. The proportion received by each is about half and half as far as the overall volume. Prior to the launch of the MARC, the total number of reports was between 30 to 35,000 per year. Starting around 2012 up until the launch of the MARC. It was a little bit lower prior to that. the number of allegations you'll see is higher than the number of reports. So the total number of allegations that were comprised in these reports was 79,557, and that's because each report may include more than one type of allegation. The percents that are shown here for the different types of maltreatment are the percent of allegations that were taken in, and so caregiver neglect being the highest percentage at 30% and so on. Of all the allegations that were then referred to lead investigative agencies, so there's that the 79,557 number again for calendar year 18. A little over half of those allegations were referred to counties in their lead investigative agency role, 34% to the Office of Health Facility Complaints at the Health Department, and then 12% to DHS licensing. Notifications to law enforcement over the last few years has seen a steady increase in terms of those notifications. Emergency Protective Services notifications has seen a slight decrease. We don't have validated data yet for calendar 18 regarding Emergency Protective Services, so we can provide that to you all in follow-up if you would like. The decrease in the Emergency Protective Services notifications is a result of refinement that we've made to the screening assessment to more accurately identify the need for Emergency Protective Services. And finally, the last couple slides that I have for you all today on this topic is related to the data, maltreatment data and the classification to follow up, I believe, on some questions stemming from the last committee hearing. So I'll walk through each of these pieces here in hopes that it provides some useful information for your deliberations. So in terms of an active investigation, the data on individuals who are the subject of an investigation is considered confidential data. It's not available to the individual and not available to anyone else either while that investigation is active. Likewise, protected non-public data on a business or entity is not available to the subject or anyone outside of that entity holding the data. So that is also during an active investigation. When an investigation is determined to be inactive, data on the individual shifts from confidential to private data, and private data is data that identifies an individual and is available only to the subject of that data, so it would only be available to that individual. And then inactive investigation data also includes data on licensed providers, and that is includes public data, but is without personal identifiers, of course. The reporter's identity is always protected. And finally, I just wanted to make sure you were aware that at the MARC, the data that's collected through the reports and then is referred to our different partners in the system is confidential, because the MARC is not a lead investigative agency. Those are the three entities that I've been referring to, which are the counties, DHS, and the health department. Decisions on the data release need to be made by the lead investigative agency responsible for decisions on the report response and investigation, and initial and final disposition decisions and status of appeals made to the LIA determine the classification of the data and the practice rules that apply to the MARC data. And in my last slide, we wanted to highlight that lead investigative agencies may share data during investigation with affected parties and authorized representatives if the lead investigative agency has reason to believe maltreatment occurred and the data sharing is needed to safeguard affected parties or dispel rumors about licensed providers. And so this this allowance, you know, is really interpreted by each lead investigative agency then. This is laid out in statute, and they are responsible then for interpretation regarding that. And, again, the mark is separate from that process and that determination.
I'm going to stop you there. Representative Gruenhagen, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just to, you know, on all these reportings and notifications, I know you addressed law enforcement before, but, you know, the rest of them, do you have a statistic that says how many of them are actually verifiable abuse? I mean, we got 29,987 in 17, 27,000. This year, 2018, 32,000. Well, that's the law enforcement. And, I mean, is there a percent of these complaints about abuse that actually are verified to be abuse?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, I have asked Mary McCurran, our supervisor for adult protection, and she also oversees the MARC call center contract, to answer your question for you.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mary McCurran, Department of Human Services Adult Protection Unit. The lead investigative agencies maintain information regarding the investigation dispositions for the investigations that were under their jurisdiction. So the Minnesota Department of Health makes their investigations public. The Department of Human Services licensing, their investigations are public. The county investigations are found on our dashboard on DHS public reports, and it shows the county investigations and all of the determinations, and it can be dived into county by county as well.
Representative Gruenhagen?
Thank you, Manager. So you have no overall statistic of what's actually verifiable versus a reported abuse?
Ms. McCurran?
Yes. We do not have information on all lead investigative agencies. That's one of the data points that Carrie Benson mentioned earlier are being put together.
Okay.
Right. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can investigators review what has been previously determined as inconclusive or no determination when they are given new cases regarding maybe the same facility or the same provider or the same vulnerable adult? Are they able to look back into that information, or is it capped at the 3 years or whatever you had mentioned before?
Ms. Benson or Ms. McCurran?
This is Mary McCurran. So it's by lead investigative agency, and so we would not be able to answer for each lead investigative agency. The data is destroyed, consistent with the statute. For county lead investigative agencies, they do have access to that information through the social service information system.
Okay.
Representative Munson?
Yeah, and the numbers that we saw, these high-level numbers of reports, the 29,000 or 32,000 cases reported, are those have those cases been deduped by, like, vulnerable, like, if my grandmother is, if I suspect she's being abused in a facility, I may call, my wife may call, somebody else may have called, but has that been deduped by case, or are those, like, raw numbers of phone calls and reports of, is it that big, or is it really like a third that number?
Ms. McCurran?
Madam Chair, that data for reports and allegations is not deduplicated, so it may include multiple reports of the same incident made by different reporters or multiple reports of the same incident made by the same reporter. It's deduplicated at the lead investigative agency level.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed, Ms. Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to shift gears now and talk about the Assisted Living Report Card Work Group. And this is the work group that I had the pleasure of chairing as a part of the Minnesota Department of Health-led effort to convene stakeholders after last legislative session to continue our work to talk through the areas related to older and vulnerable adult abuse and to identify areas of consensus. Starting in the nursing home area, now in assisted living, the Department of Human Services has taken a consistent approach to promoting and rewarding quality in long-term services and supports for older adults. And we sometimes refer to this as our version of a three-legged stool. You'll see the three here. Valid measurement system, a system to develop valid, reliable, and meaningful measures of quality across multiple domains that are important to the people who receive the services as well as their family members. So that's one component of our overall effort. Public reporting, which is where the assisted living report card comes in, is focused on sharing information with the public and primarily people who would be interested in moving into assisted living, family members and others, to inform their purchasing decisions and also offer a bit of peer pressure to affect quality among providers. And then finally, value-based purchasing. DHS, as a payer of assisted living services, we call customized living, through the elderly waiver, we're very interested in ensuring that services that are provided to individuals who are eligible for medical assistance in assisted living is provided in the highest quality manner, and that it supports positive outcomes for people who live there and are an effective investment. So we have a lot of history of work in this area in nursing homes, and so what we're wanting to do is really build on that to provide the same types of mechanisms for assisted living, as well as then other home and community-based services. The Assisted Living Report Card Work Group quickly identified the areas of consensus that are listed on this slide. The work group met only once in this process, and I'll explain why in just a moment, but they very quickly identified and agreed that there is a need for a report card, and that as one component of an overall system to really encourage and reward and support the efforts of providers to provide high-quality services. As Commissioner Malcolm has said before, too, that we really can't regulate our way only out of the situation that we're in terms of the older and vulnerable adult abuse that we're seeing and that we're all aware of. And so we need to have multiple strategies. And one critical one, the work group felt, is to provide an assisted living report card. Unlike nursing facilities, though, the data on the quality of the services provided in assisted living and available in a valid, consistent, reliable manner is quite limited. And so that's an area that the work group very much agreed is in need of development, and that we need to coordinate our work in this area with the work underway on the assisted living licensure and the dementia care standards, which you'll hear about also in this hearing. And finally, the feedback of people who reside in assisted living and their family members is a very important component. We all felt very strongly that their voice needs to be front and center in terms of gauging the quality of the services that they are receiving. The reason the work group met only once so far is that we were able to quickly get underway a contract with the University of Minnesota to develop a framework. And so we're just in the beginning stages of this effort, and it builds on their work that they have done on our behalf for many years in the nursing home report card area. So you'll see here the steps we plan to take a systematic approach to identifying quality domains for assisted living and then working through what might be the measures within each of those domains. And this summer, we plan to engage a technical expert panel to review the proposed measures. Leading up to that point, we're going to be offering our work group, as well as the other stakeholders that have been involved with this process so far, an opportunity to provide their input and feedback and really help shape the development of the report card and be involved to the extent that they want to be. Following the technical review that will take place this summer, we've determined that work in these areas outlined here on this slide are needed to make an assisted living report card a reality. So these would be kind of consider the final steps of this work, in that we need additional resources necessary to support this work. So one would be a period of time to review the proposed quality measures, again, you know, really making sure we engage all interested stakeholders in reviewing and providing feedback on those. Funds to develop and implement ongoing resident quality of life and family satisfaction surveys. So it's the actual implementation of those. We would use existing survey instruments for that effort. And then staff support to translate the ongoing quality measurement data into ratings or measures for the assisted living sites, and then to have a public website for the report card would be the final component for which resources are needed. So we wanted to make sure that we were clear about that in terms of where we're at with our work in the assisted living report card area, and feel that's an important component of our work.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Oh, sorry, Representative Munson, you have a question.
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. I like the idea of this report card for kind of measuring care, and especially when we gather input from the public to kind of get reviews on care. I just kind of went to my phone to Google, like, assisted living, if I was going to choose my my parents' facility, which was always been my threat since I was a little child. I get to pick out where you retire. But the, you know, they came up with a bunch of things like caring.com, aplaceformom.com, seniorliving.com, and Consumer Reports has a big review, and then assisted senior living. Do any of these private, non-governmental sites, I assume they're non-governmental, have benefits that would be, there would be overlap with what the government is going to be doing in creating a report card? Or is there anything that's out in the private, you know, marketplace that would really be a better tool than government compiling data for this, in your opinion?
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair and committee members, what we have found is pretty limited. So it's either based on provider self-reports, so it's not consistent across all settings, assisted living settings. There's some ways that I think the private vendors or the private companies that have these sites, one of the things we have learned from and see from them is probably the more consumer-friendly ways of providing the data and the information to individuals. So we are including that in our scope of, you know, our environmental scanning, and just making sure we're aware of what are the best practices out there. And it includes other states' efforts, too. We do feel strongly, and the stakeholders we've engaged so far feel strongly that that it's important to have it come from a public sector entity, to have the make sure that it is very much neutral, objective, and valid system across all settings, regardless of payer. You know, so if you're on a public pay program or if you're paying privately.
Thank you. I think we're going to. Oh, Representative Seaborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I just looked at the dashboard, and it does say, I mean, I found it very easy to navigate and very easy to find the question that was answered earlier. It does give it by county, and in the very the top line, it does also give the totals by type of investigation. But I just wanted to say it was very easy to navigate and to find the information. So thank you for making that very clear and easy to find. So it's really just a comment.
Thank you, Representative Seaborn. I think we're going to bring our next speaker down, and we have Cheryl Hennen, the State Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Ms. Hennen, you have about 15 minutes for your presentation so we can make room for the third presentation. So please introduce yourself for the record.
And, Madam Chair, I'm hoping nobody assumes I'm going to find her PowerPoint for her or Cheryl. So we need some help with that. But while that is happening, if I could just do a little introduction of Cheryl Hennen as the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. As I mentioned in my introduction, I serve dual roles, both as a director of the Aging and Adult Services Division at the Department of Human Services, and then I get the pleasure of also serving as executive director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. And I would be remiss and get in a lot of trouble from the board members themselves if I didn't strongly state the support that the Minnesota Board on Aging has. It's a 25-member governor-appointed board from around members from around the state, and they have strong and passionate support for Cheryl Hennin as a long-term care ombudsman and her team. And you will have hear from her in a lot more detail about the work that they do, but wanted to make sure you all knew, as one of the two direct service programs of the board, that they are strongly in support of Cheryl and her work.
Thank you for the introduction. Please proceed, Ms. Hennin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Cheryl Hennin, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and I want to thank all of you for your service and for allowing me some time on your agenda today. Apologize for sort of the kind of cold I'm battling. I am very proud to represent the Subcommittee on Consumer Rights, and I will talk a little bit about what the committee meetings involved, and then introduce you a little bit to what the work of the Ombudsman's Office includes. The subcommittee discussed numerous issues related to rights, and there's so much more detail in the final report. We met four times. We identified valuable areas for further discussion. And the one thing I ask you to think about each time, there will be much proposed legislation regarding elder rights, elder abuse. As you navigate through those pieces of legislation, I really ask you to consider, does the proposed legislation adequately uphold resident rights? And if not, is change necessary? If so, in what way? This is also a responsibility of me as your state long-term care ombudsman, so I'm available to you should you ever need assistance. It has and continues to be an honor to work with such a wide variety of stakeholders. So that's something else to think about. Some of them are in this room today. It was a wonderful opportunity to have many people at the table to come to consensus. The areas of consensus are identified through three focus areas: strengthening rights, enforcement of rights, and education about rights. Strengthening rights, and this was not something that I campaigned a lot on. It came out naturally on its own, and I'm very proud to say that full consensus for increased funding to the Ombudsman's Office. The Ombudsman's Office is a person-centered consumer protection service that resolves problems and advocates for the rights of individual. So you will see, that's why I wanted to talk a little bit more about our work. The subcommittee was unanimous on supporting the increase of funding for the office. We talked a fair amount about deceptive marketing practices in care settings and improving and expanding avenues for relief of resident right violations. Giving you some highlights on enforcement of rights, what types of things did we discuss? The need for clarity and consolidation of the Bill of Rights in Housing with Services and Assisted Living. Because there are, and it would probably fill part of this table to give you a visual, there are numerous sets of potentially applicable rights in assisted living housing with services. And this also becomes a point of education and for consumers, because it's such a cumbersome process, people may not be able to identify their rights and then feel empowered to even enforce them. And we know that there have been efforts in the past where people have attempted to consolidate the Home Care Bill of Rights, the Housing with Services to Living Bill of Rights, all in one comprehensive Bill of Rights. And so we feel that consideration needs to be given to establishing one comprehensive Bill of Rights in Housing with Services Assisted Living. So unanimously, consensus on prohibition against retaliation. Fear of retaliation is one of the most common reasons residents do not want to pursue a complaint and disclose their identity. Since residents live in a facility and they rely on staff for their basic needs, they fear retaliation should they complain. What does retaliation look like? How does it manifest itself? In our work, we see it happen for example, should someone file a grievance, they may experience then the issue of an involuntary discharge notice. Abuse could be another form of how retaliation is manifested. So what's important for us to make sure that we do is to clearly define what is retaliation, what is the evidence we use, and how do we measure retaliation. Consistent enforcement of rights in assisted living. So in this area, we talked about a need for consistent enforcement of the Bill of Rights in assisted living. We discussed creating a clear pathway to private right of action and increased penalties to deter abuse violations and hold accountable those who violate resident rights. We also discussed the fact that the Department of Health should, at a minimum, have the resources available to comply with statutory language regarding how often Housing with Services Assisted Living should be surveyed, and that should be on a regular basis, and that's within statute. An area related to both education and enforcement discussed is to clearly define rights versus duties and the need to clarify that within the Bill of Rights. Rights and duties are closely related and cannot be separated from one another. They must go side by side. So to give you an example, in the federal nursing home, Bill of Rights that are guaranteed by the 1987 Nursing Home Reform Law, nursing home resident rights require that the nursing home staff promote and protect the rights of each resident, identifying specific rights and duties. If you read the Housing with Services Assisted Living Bill of Rights, for example, and that's within state statute, it is not clear in the statute the duty or the obligation of others to promote and protect the rights of individuals. We had a discussion about that. Resident and family councils, this was another clear area of consensus. The purpose of resident councils is to give residents greater participation in affairs within their own home, to make suggestions about improvements and assist administration in providing better programming, promote friendship, understanding. There's so many good reasons why resident councils are important. So this was a very unanimous consensus that we work to ensure that people know that having resident councils in assisted living is very important and that there should be a space provided for them. Minnesota, I'm not sure how many of you know this, but Minnesota is a front runner in the creation of both resident and family councils. This was an effort that Minnesota actually started in the late 70s, and many states do ask. In fact, just last week, another state had contacted me to say, could you tell us what you've been doing in that area? So it's a proud thing for Minnesota to be able to know that we've made so many strides in this. It's also a form of empowerment. I will also state that this is what is working well, because we heard from a number of providers who are committee meetings that they have this type of organization that they support within their particular living environments. We also talked, and you will hear this if you haven't also written and proposed legislation in this area, we talked about appeal rights to service termination and the right to due process. So what does that mean? That means if you are living in an assisted living environment and you are served a notice of service termination, you may only have 10 days. It's a 10-day notice, and then you have no right to appeal that. As comparison, in the nursing home rights, a person is issued a 30-day notice of involuntary discharge. They have a right to appeal and a right to due process. So we did talk about how we need additional consumer rights included in recent service terminations in Housing with Services Assisted Living and improved discharge planning. So an example of this could include when an assisted living Housing with Services facility closes. There needs to be a good process in place in order to make sure that people are not arbitrarily discharged. Very good discussion on that area. So this slide, I will not go through the detail, but I wanted to include where is the authority. It's in federal and in state law. The Older Americans Act is where the mandated responsibilities of the Ombudsman's Office rest, and also within Minnesota state statute. I want to give you a few case examples so that you understand, well, tell us what the Ombudsman does. And because the Ombudsman is mandated to have a presence in facilities, we are most often the first person that someone might talk to about abuse. They may not want their identity revealed, but we may be the first trusted person that they will talk to. So in sexual abuse in northern Minnesota, in this particular case, a 78-year-old woman with end-stage Alzheimer's dementia residing in an assisted living setting was unable to care for herself. She was unable to walk, required extensive assistance for all activities, including turning and repositioning, feeding, and toileting. She was sexually assaulted by a staff person in the spring of 2016. The regional ombudsman, which is my staff member, we have regions configured around the state. So the regional ombudsman in that area was informed. She had already been working with this individual on some complaints about her care. So she was informed that this had happened. After learning about this, my regional ombudsman did go to the location. She was the one that the victim was most comfortable with at her side. She needed to go through a series of rape kits, if you will, and so my staff member attended with her to the hospital. And also, when most people felt that counseling would not benefit a woman that had this diagnosis, we found her counseling and were able to provide her with support for follow-up. The financial exploitation case was a 71-year-old woman. She was admitted to a locked memory care unit by her niece, who was the attorney in fact, or power of attorney. She was admitted shortly after her husband of 27 years died, leaving her as the sole owner of a farm estate and substantial financial assets. The niece of the resident disconnected her phone, the resident's phone, and instructed staff not to allow the resident to leave the floor. So my staff member in the area was contacted to investigate these concerns, including the resident did not need memory care and was being held against her will. So subsequently, my regional staff member involved the county adult protection worker, and both agreed that the resident appeared to be alert and orientated, and arranged for a psychological assessment performed by a psychologist trained to do these types of testings, and she was deemed competent and able to handle her own affairs. The resident eventually removed her niece as attorney in fact. She appointed a longtime employee of her farm to help her manage her operation of the farm, and then she also agreed to a conservator to help her manage her financial affairs, and she was moved from the locked memory care unit into an independent apartment. Does it always end that beautiful? No, not always, but I share that with you to give you a sense of what kind of work is it that they do. I also, on this slide, the office is significantly understaffed. And the number, so studies were conducted by the Institute of Medicine, Congressional Research Service, and what happened from those studies was the national ratio was defined as one regional ombudsman to 2,000 active beds. So right now, Minnesota is ranked at the bottom, which is 1 in 9,000. So we are working to reduce this disparity in obtaining an appropriation for more staff. Was there a question?
Yes, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the statute that grants you authority refers to volunteers,
right,
for your program, having to have 12 hours, right, of continuing ed. Is the number of volunteers included in your staffing, or do you have volunteers that help you in your department?
Ms. Hennen? Madam Chair, committee members, that is an excellent question. Thank you for catching that.
Yes, we do have volunteers. We have 35 volunteers. The regional ombudsmen have a duty within their prescription, their positions, to provide supervision of those volunteers. So that's why there is a direct relationship between, because we can't set them out there all on their own. But I'm proud to say that we do have 35 volunteers, and we hope to continue recruitment in order to reach that mandate of a presence. Thank you for the question.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. In relationship to those volunteers, do they have to have certain qualifications, like retired, you know, law enforcement or medical personnel, or is it just anybody can volunteer?
Lieutenant?
Madam Chair, committee members, so even you, too, Representative, could become a volunteer, because we do not have specifics related to their background. They do have to pass a background check, and we do put them through rigorous training. So we do have many people that are interested, and we're working towards adding to the number. Good question. Thank you. So in the sake of time, because we have another great speaker to come, the maps, what I am showing you on these maps, and you may want to look at these in more detail later, is if you see a green symbol, that is where the regional ombudsman is located. Each region is identified by a number. We have nursing homes by region, and example on region 2 is larger than 9 states combined. We also have assisted living housing with services Minnesota map, and I carved out the metro for you because it's also very dense, and even though you see a number of red dots, there's a number of multiple dots behind some of them in order to, it was impossible to get all of them on this map. But I share these with you to show that the growth in the population and other factors have certainly created the need for more advocacy. So the maps are there for you to see, to visualize where we're at right now with coverage in the state. The complaints to the Ombudsman Office are increasing. I have a graph to show you that. And I focus on elder abuse complaints. 150% increase has been in complaints about abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation between the years of 2015 and 2018. The increase in complaints to our office is certainly, unfortunately, consistent with other agencies and departments, including the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services. But the one thing to keep in mind is people are not mandated to call us. So the number of complaints that we are receiving, they are coming from residents, family members, particularly family members representing residents and others. Also, we work on providing consultations and training. We work side by side with many providers on the issues that come to our attention.
Ms. Hennen, the 7 offices you have throughout the state, are those mandated in statute of where they're located, or does your office have they selected those locations based on need?
Madam Chair, committee members, another great question. So the there is no law that mandates where they are to be placed. Where they are placed is some of them are community locations, which means we lease space, and that is to provide access should people want to come visit us outside of their facilities. And some of them, some of the staff live, or they work out of their homes. And so that's another reason why some of them, but I'm trying to move away from in-home and more community-based locations.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask you this question, too. I've received a few complaints by people with power of attorney, like let's just say my mom, who's not in assisted living, she's on her own right now, or a nursing home. But let's say she was, and she filed a complaint about a abuse, or I did, somebody else did. If I had power of attorney, can I have access to the findings of that investigation, either by law enforcement or by some other organization?
Madam Chair, committee members, I may not be able to answer that in exact because I know that. So power of attorney is either financial or health care.
Yep.
In addition, so it would be determining what that language states as well as what type of information you're looking for. So if you are looking to get the release of a report, what the findings of a report are, I believe that it may not be possible to receive findings of that at this time.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Grun.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that's been the complaint or concern, is that they can't get the actual results of an investigation, even if they have a power of attorney or some legal document that says they can have access to health information. I don't know if we can rectify that, but it is a matter of great concern that the people legally given the responsibility of care for that person, if there's an abuse, they can't actually see the conclusion of the investigation.
Right.
Seems to be maybe something we could get straightened out. But anyway, final thoughts.
Well, Ms. Benson may be able to address that.
Madam Chair, I unfortunately am not, but I'm looking at Mary McGurn, our Adult Protection Supervisor, to see if she could join us again here and provide a little bit more detail. I just worry about getting a detail wrong for all of you.
And I will say, Madam Chair, committee members, your point is very, very well taken. If I would be the power of attorney for health care for my parents, and I receive information that there is an abuse report, I would certainly want to have access to that information. So I really appreciate the attention to this. Mary?
Ms. Go ahead, Ms. McCurran.
Madam Chair and committee members, in regards to the information about an investigated report from Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, if DHS or the Health Department are the lead investigative agency, all of their investigations are public, so the public information about that provider would be available on the website regardless of the investigation decision. If it's a county investigated report, the data practices requirements that Carrie Benson went over earlier would apply, and the individual themselves can ask for information about them, and they would also get the investigation disposition. So a person who's a power of attorney can just work with the individual for whom they're acting as power of attorney to complete the data practices requests for the information about that person.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, follow-up.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So for clarification purposes, if I have power of attorney for health, then I can get the findings of any of the investigations?
Madam Chair and committee.
Yes or no?
It depends on the powers that you have, but you can assist the person because it's the information about the vulnerable adult that you're assisting. They would be able to ask for that information. So you can get it by working with the person for which you're acting as the power of attorney.
We're going to have Representative Munson ask his question, and we'll come back to
you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about slide 4, which is the prohibition against retaliation. If a person in, like my grandmother, was going to be discharged either for non-payment or because she's been abusive to staff or whatever, if I filed a complaint against them to start an investigation, then they would be prohibited from discharging my grandmother, whatever. Have you had many cases of this where a case is started and then it's found to be non-sufficient, but maybe it's people are doing this to prevent retaliation? You know what I'm kind of getting at is like false claims. Is there a large number of these, abuse of this system to prevent discharge of their care?
Go ahead, Ms.
Hennig. Madam Chair, committee members, yes, there is.
Okay.
And I appreciate the attention that will be brought to this subject during this session.
Okay.
Very good point. Thank you, Representative.
Last question goes to Representative Clyburn.
I'm going to pass. Draw my question.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hennen. Next up, we have Beth McMullen, Vice President of Government Affairs of the Alzheimer's Association. She is going to share with us the recommendations of the Dementia Standards Work Group. Is Beth in the room? Yes, there you are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. We'll get your slides up.
Yeah, in one second.
But go ahead and proceed since we have only like 12 minutes left.
We'll give it a start. My name is Beth McMullen. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs from the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota, North Dakota chapter. I just want to point out that we have many great folks in the audience here today in purple for our Alzheimer's Rally Day. I know a number of these advocates are meeting with you, and thank you very much for your time to talk with them today about their own personal stories. I was pleased to serve as the convener of the Dementia Standards Work Group at the request of Commissioner Malcolm last fall. You heard from her last week about the assisted living license work group and kind of the overall, all the groups working together. So this is very much connected. My conversation today is very much connected with what she talked about last week. So she asked us to lead an open discussion on this issue, to seek consensus where we could, and to identify and dig into areas of disagreement to better understand our differences. Our group met a total of four times over the course of a few months. We had nearly 50 people signed up for our work group, with about 25 who participated in our conversation on a regular basis. Participants included a broad group of stakeholders ranging from interested community members to elder law attorneys, agency reps from MDH and DHS, to individual long-term care providers, paid caregivers, and their representatives. Our work group identified a number of goals, and that was really to build trust, have open conversations, and to try to develop some recommendations. And I think our group did a pretty good job. While we did not develop a legislative proposal per se, we did come a long way in identifying the consensus and disagreement, areas of consensus and disagreement, as well as recommending a general framework for dementia standards. I want to note that about a third of housing with services facilities are currently registered as dementia or memory care units. So at the time of our report, it was about 625 of the 1,718 housing with service facilities that were calling themselves and registered as dementia or memory care. At our first meeting, we talked about our vision for high-quality dementia care across all care settings, but we decided that with the limited time that we had, we really wanted to focus on the assisted living license framework discussion that the commissioner was leading simultaneously to ensure that we had strong dementia recommendations for that group moving forward. So what you see here is the person-centered focus wheel. The vision is outlined in our report, so I don't want to go into that into too much detail. However, I wanted to share this person-centered focus wheel, as we often refer to it in our discussions. This wheel represents the key components in the Alzheimer's Association Dementia Care Practice Recommendations. These care practice recommendations outline what is needed for quality care practices and are based on a comprehensive review of current evidence, best practice, and expert opinion. These care practice recommendations were released in 2018, and I'd be happy to share those with the committee as well. So the general recommendations coming out of the Dementia Standards Work Group at the highest level were three. That people living with Alzheimer's disease and or other dementias are not required to live in a dementia care setting. Two, that there should be additional license and certification requirements, i.e. minimum standards for dementia care settings. And the third, where we got pretty close, and the reason why it's in yellow is that there's still a few details to work out, is since we do know that people with dementia will live in all settings, that all assisted living settings should meet minimum dementia training requirements. And I think the kind of the holdout on that is there might be some facilities that don't serve an older population that is going to have dementia. So I think we can get there on that language. So those were the high-level recommendation. In order to focus our discussions better, we broke our work group in our work into three general categories: building on existing training requirements, enhancing disclosure related to dementia care settings, and identifying minimum standards for dementia care certification. the limited time that we have, I'm not going to spend too much time on the training and disclosures, but I just want to show the slides generally. Our basis for this, again, was to build on the existing training requirements already in law and make them applicable to the new assisted license framework. A couple of things of note, we did say for dementia care settings, particularly for training, this time frame from date of hire to when training is completed by direct care staff should be shortened in dementia care settings. And the second additional training consideration is that any untrained staff, so until they have passed and met the training requirements, they should be supervised by on-floor competent trained staff. So in disclosure, again, we did talk about building on what is already existing in current law. A couple of places where we thought we might be able to improve disclosure is making sure that this disclosure is publicly available, that the MARC information, how to make reports, like you were just hearing about from Carrie Benson, is very easily found and available. And then also making sure that there are emergency procedures that take into consideration the particular needs of people living with dementia. So where I'd like to spend a little bit more of our time is talking about the minimum standards. So first and foremost, our group said that any minimum dementia standards in assisted living in assisted living settings should not be in conflict with nursing home standards. We went back and forth on not in conflict with or parallel with nursing home standards. Our intention is not to create mini nursing homes, but we also want to make sure that that the messaging on dementia standards is consistent across settings. So we settled on the language of not in conflict with nursing home standards. We also talked about training, and again, that's those two slides before, really building on the existing training, just to ensure that staff have the skills, training, and education to assess and provide for care for a resident population with dementia. Our group also agreed on 24-hour awake staff in dementia settings. Again, building on the disclosure already existing in law with a couple of the key points that I mentioned. So where we were close, but we just need a little bit more work, and I think as the technical language comes forward through the legislative process, we will be at the table, and a number of the other stakeholders are going to be at the table to bring us to completion on this. We will be able to find agreement. But a couple of the areas that we talked about important in terms of dementia standards are for activity programming based on the resident needs, resident population needs for that facility. This takes into consideration a resident's cognitive ability, their memory, attention span, language, reasoning ability, what they want to do. Really keep it person-centered. The second piece is a behavior support plan that emphasizes non-pharmacological practices to address behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. So this is just to ensure that the staff have ways of managing common symptoms of people with dementia in a way that doesn't necessarily go for medical management first, but really identify and look for alternative ways of managing that. So the next one, medical management, kind of goes hand in hand with that. Medical management to maximize the health and well-being for people with dementia, including when the non-pharmacological measures fail. Say that word three times fast. I'm trying to get it out. So sometimes we know that a behavior support plan isn't going to be enough, and there may be a need, and it may be called for to have use of some medications to help relieve the distress of the person with dementia. The final area where we were close but just needs a little bit more work and I think is really very closely linked with the assisted living license work is around the physical environment. Is this a safe environment for an individual with dementia? We want to make sure that it promotes safety, minimizes confusion and overstimulation, things like flooring patterns, of course a secured setting if there's a concern about wandering, and a number of other person-centered assessed needs in that physical environment, lighting, etc. So that's a quick summary of the dementia standards that we went in. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We have a question, Representative Lippert.
Thank you. Ms. McCullen, was there any conversation among the group about training of home care staff who are working with elders? Because in my experience as a pastor, it seems like families often hire a home care staff person as kind of a first step and feel like that's creating a safe environment when often it doesn't seem like that's achieved. So I'm just curious if that's part of the conversation at all.
Sure. Ms. McMullen.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did talk somewhat about home care. There are dementia training laws in place for home care direct care staff. We focused our conversation on that assisted living license framework. We really wanted to support that discussion, but yes, we recognize that we could be taking a look at a broader, at all care settings, regardless of their location, but not in great detail in this work group.
Sure. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. All thank you to the testifiers and the members. Really good work on the working group, so I appreciate everyone's effort there. And we will be taking public testimony going forward when we start hearing bills, but just a reminder that this division will not be meeting the next 2 weeks. Instead, HHS policy will meet at this time on Monday, and then February 18th, all committees are canceled for the day for learning about tribal governance. So that concludes our official business, so the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.